You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Danao Mengistu, author of All Our Names, his latest work, which was published in March by Knopf. I'll give you Danao's introduction, which you must have heard about 100 times by now. He was born in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, in 1978. But in 1980, he came to the United States with his mom and his sister to reunite with his dad, who had fled the communist revolution 2 years before. Danao graduated from Georgetown and then got his MFA from Columbia. He received a 2006 fellowship in fiction from the New York Foundation for the Arts. His first novel was The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, was a New York Times notable and awarded the Guardian First Book Award. And his second book was How to Read the Air, which was published in 2010. And he lives in Paris, I think.
No, actually, in New York right now.
Okay, because I couldn't tell from the... That's what it says on the book jacket.
Yeah.
Anyway, All Our Names is a book about two men who forge a bond, that is both beautiful and at times horrific, and about a man and a woman who form a similar bond that is beautiful and at times, and I don't know what the word is. It's also a tale of immigration, moving from one country to another. But in this case, the idea of immigration is not the true measure or the genreization of this new wave of fiction. So enough of me pontificating like I always do. So we actually have the author here. Welcome, Danao, and thanks so much for joining us today on The Avid Reader.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me what I said wrong in the synopsis and tell our listeners a little bit about the book.
Everything in the synopsis was pretty much right on, except recently I returned from Paris and have come back to New York. And other than that, you were pretty much spot on. And I think your summation of the novels is fairly accurate. It's very much a portrait of two different relationships, both of which are sort of centered and based on a profound love and affection, and at the same time, two relationships that are forced to undergo a series of crises, one in Africa because of the politics surrounding these two young men, and the one that happens in the United States because of the racial discrimination, because of the complexity of trying to translate your experiences to someone who has never gone through those stories before.
Well, you know, I've listened to, you know, your interview at The Strand and a couple of other ones, and it's not that you seem sensitive about the idea of, hey, this is just another immigration novel, but like in the past 4 weeks, I interviewed Laura Vopner. She wrote The Scent of Pine, which is immigration from... I interviewed Gary on Little Failure. Mm-hmm. By the way, I love that mockumentary about his blurbing.
Yeah.
Which he was doing as late as yesterday. then I interviewed Akhil Sharma on family life. So you're the fourth in 4 weeks that deal with immigration from either India or Russia. And now Africa. So, tell me about how you feel about this, because I didn't look at it. I never looked at it as a book about immigration, ever, not in one page.
Yeah, no, and I don't. Sometimes I tend to resist the categorization of immigrant novel or immigrant literature because it seems so minimal, you know, like it's such a total way of trying to describe a narrative that is oftentimes trying to do so many other things, migration being one element of it. And the story does have, you know, one part of the narrative is about someone coming to America and finding a relationship and trying to reconstruct their life. But it's also so much more about how our seemingly different lives have to eventually, or sometimes are forced to converge in different ways. And so categorization of our stories is just one of migration, I think, leaves out the other half, that like we're not only leaving places, but we're coming to someplace new as well. And when we come to someplace new, we're sort of adopted or rejected into these societies. And so for me, what I'm always more curious about, rather than just one categorization or one definition of a narrative, it's very much about how people are managed or forced to sometimes come together, and all the reasons and all the challenges that they face in order to do so. So,
yeah, it's like people use the word assimilation. And it's funny because in your book, it's almost the opposite. You have these two incredibly different contextual relationships, and yet they're very similar. And it's not like, okay, I'm gone from here where all these horrible things happen. Now I'm here and everything is different and I have to move myself into it. In fact, the two experiences, as you obviously meant them to be, the relationships, and this is what's so good for the reader because it makes the reader work, the two relationships have a great deal in common.
They do. They do. They very much echo one another. And, you know, while writing the novel, I realized, you know, it began very much with the story of these young men on a college campus in Africa, and then quickly took on a second voice, of the voice of Helen, the woman who narrates that parts of the novel that take place in the United States. And once those two narrative voices began to emerge, they quickly turned into a sort of conversation. So some of the things that were happening in Africa found their sort of mirror partner in the United States. So you can have a group of young men who are being beaten or discriminated against in a cafe in Kampala because of their poverty, because of the fact that they don't belong socioeconomically. And at the same time, you see a couple at a diner in the United States who are being discriminated against because of the color of their skin, because it's an interracial relationship that people are uncomfortable with. And it's one way of showing how we can mirror these, not only these experiences, but the politics that sort of surround them once we begin to localize them in the space of a single individual or in the space of a couple.
Yeah, it's funny because that scene in the restaurant is the first time you realize it. And this is why it's shouldn't be pigeonholed. In the scene in the restaurant, you first realize, hey, Helen's got some issues, you know? She's...
Yeah.
You kind of just... It goes, wait a minute. Is this... Why exactly is she doing... Anyway, so when I first see a book where it has alternating chapters, like you look at the table of contents and it's Helen, Isaac, Helen, Isaac, Helen, Isaac, Helen, Isaac for two pages, I get a little nervous and I go, oh, am I going to like this? How are the transitions going to be like? But then they... Even though the stories were so far apart, it melded together really nicely and you actually... I felt very comfortable in the switch from one to another. In fact, sometimes you kind of fooled me. For example, when I switched from one Helen to Isaac, the first line of the new chapter is, when I woke the next morning, Isaac was standing over me, nudging me gently in the back with his foot. And I thought, wait a minute, this is supposed to be Isaac now. Why is that still Helen?
I would love to believe that all of that was, you know, sort of some part of a master plot to merge every single little detail together, but it did happen, I think, quite organically. You know, these characters were very much in conversation with one another. So something would happen in Isaac chapters of the novel, and then almost immediately afterwards, Helen would find a way of picking up that piece. You know, there would be a way in which suddenly her experiences were so closely embedded or attached to what had happened in the other part of this novel that it was almost inevitable that you would find echoes and traces of that in her life. And it's nice to sometimes ask a reader to pause and leap into another narrative voice and into another narrative space. You know, that sometimes works both as a challenge and also a sort of release. You know, so you occupy one space as deeply as you can. And then at the same time, you can sort of hit pause and ask the reader or invite the reader to step into another world and say, like, you hopefully have engaged with this reality, with the sort of complex politics of a college campus in 1970 in Kampala. And now if you just you know, continue that capacity of imagination, you can sort of move to a diner in the Midwest or to a small college town in the Midwest and still find yourself just as deeply attached and just as deeply connected to the experiences that are happening there, even though neither experience may mirror your own, or perhaps one mirrors your own and the other one doesn't. Nonetheless, when you force them together, when they sort of rub alongside each other, they hopefully have, you know, some compelling force for the reader that makes them feel very, very whole.
Yeah, it's funny. But you know what I mean, though, right? In some novels where there's alternating chapters, you go, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I wanted to get back to her because, you know, what's happening to her? Whereas in yours, and it's kind of scary, I mean, in a way, because it flows so smoothly. And it's funny when you said, I think you said something about paper, but without giving anything away, you know, there's a piece of paper in this book.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's, okay, have I been formulating this in my head the entire time I've been reading this book? So it's really nice because there's really, you know, there's three people, one being the reader involved, but then I forgot about Rose. And I read this, I don't know if you read this one, where they did a poll who was their favorite character. And
I haven't seen that.
6% picked Rose.
Well, that's what it says about the novel, but
I don't.
I love Rose as a character, even though she's fairly on the sidelines for much of the novel. She does still serve, I think, a pretty critical function. And even, you know, within that passage that you meant about Helen writing down on a piece of paper when just before she goes into the diner with Isaac, we have every right to be here. You know, that small little gesture also has, you know, a strong echo with what happens in that campus in Kampala, where the two narrators, or the two young aspiring revolutionaries, you know, create this paper revolution where they're writing down the sort of absurdity of, or they're mocking the absurdity of the government's declarations of all the things that they can't do and shouldn't do as a way of asserting all the things that they should be able to do. And suddenly you find Helen, you know, saying, like, we have every right to be in this diner, even though that may come with certain obstacles and certain challenges.
That's funny. I just realized how important paper and words on paper make a difference in this book. I just realized that.
Yeah. And then, you know, that ties in very closely to how much the novel is also concerned about the power of naming, you know, sort of the ability to declare what something is or is not, and all the sort of authority that comes with that and all the feats of imagination that are necessary to be able to do that. So it's, you know, again, it's one of those things that you hopefully find arriving organically in the novel, and that, you know, as a writer, you embed yourself in these ideas, and bit by bit they begin to echo one another. So characters are constantly redefining and renaming themselves, and sometimes they're doing so on paper, and sometimes those words are being obliterated even as they try to do so.
Yeah, it's funny because talk about organic. If you did you vet the cover? Did they give you several covers? Because covers fascinate me. Did you?
In this case, they always let you vet the cover. But as soon as we tweaked this cover very, very, very minimally. The initial version was wonderful. You know, I love this cover. It's so sensitive to what the novel is and to so many of the themes that happen in the novel, and to even specific moments inside of the novel that. The cover just sort of encapsulated more than I could have ever hoped for.
Yeah, it's like a spoiler that I can talk about because it's the first thing anybody sees, you know?
Yeah.
It's and what the cover is, because some of you might not have seen it, is it's just the words, all our names, and it's just crossed through. And it's about what Danal's saying about names are very important, but at the same time, you can lose them. Sometimes you want to lose them. And you know, I have an independent bookstore, so everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover. But unfortunately, every single person who comes in does judge every book by its cover.
Yeah. And if we didn't judge books by the cover, we wouldn't care so much about the covers, I guess.
I know. And also, even when you pick it up, the texture of the cover, somehow it manifests something, too. So whoever, publishers must know what they're doing.
And the texture of that paper almost feels like, you know, when I first touched it, I thought immediately of the chalkboard. And that scene in the novel where the two young men are trying to write an imaginary formula for a bomb on this chalkboard. And, of course, what they're writing is in marker and can't be erased. But they know as well that what they're writing makes no sense. It's just pure gibberish. It's an act of imagination, an act of sort of wishful thinking that they're engaging in. And the covers seem to grab hold of that as well.
Yeah, it's cool because there's another basically piece of paper. And it's really like a piece of paper because it isn't chalk, so it's indelible. That's pretty interesting. You know, it's funny because the beginning, that portion seems so playful. You know, it's like two tiger cubs playing before they grow up.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
They're playing, you know, it's they're trying to engage in one last act of sort of almost delusion. You know, they want to hold on to some form of innocence, even though that innocence is definitely tinged with the sort of veneer of violence. But they also know that what's going to come next will be, or has the potential to be, so much worse than what they've already gone through. And so, you know, this little pause that they have, this little playful back and forth, is one way of kind of suspending a little bit of holding on to a little bit of innocence that they know is already kind of receding into the background.
Yeah, I know, and it's like this kind of, I don't mean to put it, you know, to lower it, but it's like kind of this buddy movie film where there's one guy that has this tremendous amount of courage and aplomb, and the other guy's following him and actually very closely given what happens, and doesn't necessarily live up to him, but kind of is there for him in a way. Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
But yeah, no, definitely yeah.
You know, it's funny though, because in the interview in The Strand, you kept talking about good revolutionaries and how you turn into a bad revolutionary. And it's really hard for me to think of that. Like, you take Joseph, for example. He seems, and the key word is seems, to maybe be a good revolutionary. But it always boils down to, and I know it's a cliche, that power corrupts. And, I mean, you or me or any other nice person, if you give them power or total power, you're going to be corrupted. It just happens. There doesn't seem to be any cure for it in my mind. Or do you disagree with that?
Well, in Joseph's case, you know, the power does sort of corrupt me. I think he begins very much with the best intentions. He has, he has a sort of profound frustration, as do many people do, with the government that, is running the country that he's a part of. And so he wants to react against that, and he wants to respond, I think, in the best possible way. But I think really quickly what happens is that desire to do something well when it's ensconced in violence, when violence becomes the dominant form of political expression, then violence will sort of overwhelm the narrative, you know. So it's possible to have a desire for power, so long as that power exists within a context that can maintain some control over it, as long as there are institutions and societal functions that will keep that power from going unchecked and that can allow that power to do more than assert itself through violent acts. And in this case, in Joseph's case in particular, he's not left with too many other choices. You know, like, you can't go to a voting box, you can't run for president in any viable way, and so he automatically resorts to the traditional form of military actions and the violence that comes with that. And then quickly, you know, that violence overwhelms him. I think that violence overwhelms the movement that he's trying to start, and all the characters then become perverted as a result of that.
It's funny because in your interviews, both written and televised, you spend a lot of time talking about the concept of, I don't know, you seem almost frustrated about it, of the idea of checks and balances, how this could work if, and my point is that I don't know where the if comes from, you know, especially in the situation you describe in your book. Where is the if? Where is the, you know, the, where are you? You have a very thin skin of civilization, and once you break through it, even in the slightest way, it's very difficult to go back again, whether it's Vietnam or Iraq or Rwanda or the Sudan or Syria or perhaps now the Ukraine. Once someone pierces that thin skin of civilization, anything is possible. And the things that destroy both the life of the they destroy both the life of the destroyer and the destroyed.
Yeah, no, and that's, you know, it's there are scenes that I think are directly related to that idea that when forced into difficult situations, that the sort of, as you said, that thin skin of civilization can oftentimes sort of fragment and break and shatter. And you know, I think part of it is what happens when people are forced to feel like their lives are very precarious and unstable, and they have no other means of addressing that instability, that sense of sort of profound fear and anxiety that comes with not knowing what's going to happen next, and therefore seeing everything that comes to you and through you as a threat. And when that begins to happen, you realize how fragile our communities, our societies, our lives are, because our instinct is to want to defend. And if we have no other means of doing so, if we have no other means of declaring our intent, of declaring our desire for something better, and I do believe, you know, that declaration is possible, and it's possible when people have the ability to express themselves through language, through their voices, through having an ability to say, like, this is what we want, this is what we need, and know that those declarations are actually heard and reciprocated on the other side. I do think that is the only sort of tool and weapon that we have against that fracturing of civil society. But in so many cases, you see governments sort of restricting that ability. They find ways of automatically muting that and taking that authority and taking that possibility away from their communities. And when you begin to do so, you know, violence is itself its own form of language. It's a form of communication. It's the most brute and base form of communication. But when there's nothing else left, that does tend to be the things that we turn to.
Yeah, things we turn to that we never thought we would be able to in a million years.
Yeah.
That's and the thing is, there's a pivotal moment in the book when, how can I phrase this without spoiling it? When our protagonist is told, if you do something, I'll make you a lieutenant.
Yeah.
And that's pivotal because it's not done. But at the same time, it's done almost in that playful sense that they enjoyed when they were pretending to be students, you know?
Yeah. And when he says that, you know, he's at that point in time, you know, he's asking the narrator to engage in another form, in an act of violence that he knows he will not. And saying that if he does so, he will be promoted. You know, there's a deep cynicism in that, like, he knows that what's happening is that this movement, this possible idealistic revolutionary uprising is now being corrupted by the violence, and suddenly the violence is the only form of power. So what will make him a lieutenant isn't the strength of his ideas or the fact that he has other, you know, things that he can offer, but what becomes the most important thing is his ability to pull trigger in that case. And the narrator, or Isaac in that situation, is very much aware of the fact that, like, that something has gone wrong here, something has become perverted and distorted, and now what we are becoming is, rather than a group of revolutionary liberators, we're becoming a violent army.
Well, it's funny because I was just talking to the manager in our bookstore, and she had just finished reading The Goldfinch, which just won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
And she was telling me how she hated every single character in the book, but she thought the book was written in the most incredible language she's ever read, and she'll remember the names of the characters even though she hated them. And I said, well, don't you think the author, Donna Tartt, being so smart, knew that you might hate them and knew that you would be talking to someone about it and that you would remember these characters? Don't you think she had that idea? And he goes, yeah, I guess maybe I did know that. And so in your book, the same is true. I'll remember the names. Well, it's easy. There's only a couple.
Yeah.
But I'll remember the names, but there's no one really to hate, right?
Well, I hope so, yeah. I mean, you know, in this case, the characters do rather awful things, you know, but I think in some of the violent gestures that they make and in some of the naive gestures that aren't necessarily violent, but they still fail in many ways. You know, the characters are constantly disappointing each other and perhaps at times the reader. But, you know, in this particular case, I did want that disappointment and that frustration that might come with that to also be tinged with the sense that there's a more profound intent to do something good, and sometimes that desire to do something good is distorted or warped into the materialized the way the characters want them to. But they still are aspiring to something better. And so you hopefully have this sense of, you know, these characters who are flawed but at the same time rather fragile, and you know, rather idealistic at times as well.
Well, it's funny because, you know, you have those book club discussion questions at the end of your book, which I don't really like. But again, publishers are smart, and that's why they put them there.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have a couple of book clubs at our store, plus we host a bunch of them. And I know this will be one. And when it is, it's a perfect book for a book club because you're going to have half the people liking Joseph, liking...
Yeah.
And the other half are going to say, what's wrong with you? Look at what he did. How can you possibly like him?
Yeah.
And then the other person is going to say, no, but deep down, in so many ways, he was such a good person.
Yeah. No, I hope that's exactly what the case is, especially with a character like Joseph, who is you know, oftentimes easily depicted as just nothing more than a violent man whose desire to power is the only sort of thing driving him, that underneath that you still sense this, you know, this man is also capable of profound empathy and love at the same time. So you tell that you have to forgive the violent gestures that he performs or the actions that he's responsible for, but that you have to see him in a more total light, that you can't just ascribe one characterization to him, that you still have to let him exist in the space of, like, here's still somebody who has all the other traits of humanity that we respect and admire and think of when we think of full, complete human beings. And yet at the same time, he's also tinged with this, you know, aura of tragedy and violence. And so hopefully, you know, the readers will will have that frustrating challenge of realizing here are people that they both sort of are angry or disappointed or perhaps even despise, and yet at the same time, they can't reject them completely, because to reject them completely is a little bit too easy of a thing to do.
It's funny, too, because with regard to Joseph and a very important person in this book, there's this sub-subplot, almost a sub-Rosa plot, and I kind of got lost in it in the beginning. How did you choose to add that certain element in the relationship?
You mean the relationship between Joseph it came really naturally. To some degree, that Joseph is in love with this young man, and that has one way of echoing the relationship between Helen and this immigrant who comes to the United States, and the fact that their relationship, their ability to perhaps find love with one another, is undermined by this profound racial antagonism and discrimination in this community, and that antagonism, that racial discrimination, does, at its very base, it undermines the human dignity that both of these characters are trying to fulfill by loving one another. And if you're going to reject them, then you can see the same thing happening with Joseph and Isaac. They are unable to kind of complete or fulfill the fact that they are compassionate, that they care for one another, that they love one another. There's no language to describe that to each other. There's no way in which anybody can actually participate in that. And so that relationship happens very much in secret, in the same way that Isaac and Helen's relationship happens in secret because of the color of their skin. And that one happens because of the fact that they're both men. So, you wanted to push these things together and say, you can't, we can't accept one form of discrimination and permit the other, that both of them are ways of minimizing our dignity as human beings.
Yeah, it's funny because the way you underscore that is in a moment when there is an embrace and you embrace someone so hard that it hurts.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you can express what that ineluctable feeling is, and I've been in that situation because, it's difficult. Women can't be friends with one another. Women have to be friends with one another because there can't be sex, and men can't be, they can't be intimate with one another because there can't be sex. So it's your relationship is stopped by societal norms. Well, used to be stopped by societal norms. So now we've kind of switched gears. If we go to America in the 70s, a non-segregated country, but still a bigoted, which still kind of is country, what is it that Isaac and Helen are trying to achieve in their unusual relationship? And why are they not both seeking exactly the same goals? Because they're not.
I think, Isaac and Helen, they have radically different backgrounds, and yet at the same time, they share all these, strange things in common. They're both, Helen may be very deeply rooted to this small town in the Midwest, and yet she's also, I think, profoundly alienated from it, and suddenly this man, Isaac, comes to town, and through him, she finds this this opening, this opportunity to be more of who she really is. And yet at the same time, because of the fact that Isaac is black and she's white, their relationship's immediately at risk. It has to be sequestered. And so they begin to perform all the rituals of a relationship just by the fact that Helen is there to escort Isaac through his new life in America. And so even before they become a couple, they perform the gestures of a couple. They go shopping together. They go to the grocery store together. And so they have a veneer of a public life as a couple. Again, at the same time, they know that they can't ever express those things publicly. And so it's only behind closed doors that they can begin to actually find some ways of falling in love with each other. But that capacity to fall in love with each other, I think, is, it's challenged not only by the fact of the discrimination that surrounds their society, but this anxiety that both Isaac and Helen have about how can Isaac translate his experiences to her. How can he actually let her know what he's gone through and what he's been through without scaring her or without throwing her off. And she has that same fear. You know, she wants to draw closer to this man. And yet you can see that she's also a bit nervous of knowing what he's gone through, because perhaps it will be so extreme or so radically different from her own life that she won't have the capacity to empathize.
Yeah, it's funny too, because in their relationship, Helen and Isaac's in America, it echoes sometimes in order to keep their relationship intact and in control, they exercise this humor and playfulness in order to keep it from becoming a critical mass, just as Isaac did in Africa. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They had, there's a... Yeah, go ahead.
They find all sorts of ways of both drawing closer to one another, drawing closer to each other, and at the same time at the same time finding ways of avoiding having to do so. You know, those sort of jokes and the gestures that they do with those little bits of humor, you know, it's one way of sharing the intimate moment. At the same time, it's also a way of keeping them from having to say what's much harder to, you know, to point out or to acknowledge.
Yeah, it's funny, because I was talking to two people yesterday, and the one woman says, well, I have to leave now. And I said, well, we don't really need you here to have an intelligent conversation. And, you know, it's kind of a loving kind of friend. And that's the way my father was, too. It's like, you know, by him telling me I was a jackass for 20 years, it was basically, it took me therapy to figure out that he was telling me he loved me.
Yeah.
People do that because, I don't know, I guess they're frightened or something, you know.
And also because, you know, we sometimes need to manage our emotions. It's sometimes easier to be a bit coy or to couch our emotions in sardonic statements or in slightly humorous bits, because to say things directly carries a risk of not only expression but also of rejection. And so we find ways of trying to let other people know that this is who we are, this is what we think, while at the same time preserving some private space for ourselves that can't be rejected, that won't look at us askance if we say something that feels too intimate or too personal.
And people feel each other out that way, and sometimes they feel each other out for 40 years. You know, someone works with someone in the workplace, and there's this tension, and they say things, but they admit to themselves, but they never allow it to happen. And then some people break through at a moment, and once they break through, it becomes wonderful.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, it's and you know, going back to Rose, it's funny, because even though you flesh her out in only a few paragraphs, she is kind of like the Oracle in the Matrix.
she serves a very sort of like pivotal role where she becomes, you know, it's like through her that Helen is reminded of this sort of capacity to love, and the fact that, like, you know, this woman becomes the sort of guiding light for her, that, you know, she's reminded that Rose benefited and was enriched by the fact that she had someone she cared about and loved deeply, and as a result inspires in Helen the desire to want the same.
Yeah, and she even tells them where to go geographically.
Exactly.
I thoroughly enjoyed this. I read this in one sitting, and
Thank you.
And it's like I've said to some other authors too, it's like sometimes you'll go back and reread a paragraph, not because you didn't understand it the first time, but because it was so nice to read it the first time that you want to go back and read it again.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so.
No, you're welcome. So what's next? Are you going to continue to explore what you've been exploring, or are you going to do a science fiction book?
the good thing right now, or the terrible thing right now, I'm not sure which one it is, is that I'm not really sure. You know, I've had these three. I've worked on three novels now, one after the other, and they've all been so closely related that I think now is a very nice time to want to pause for a little bit and see what can happen next. So I actually don't have a clear idea, but I do feel like it'll be different. Probably won't be completely sci-fi, but you know, there's a certain liberty that comes with having, you know, run through a series of obstacles that each novel has presented, and now I feel like, okay, I can stop running for a second and see what's new in my life, what are my new priorities, and the new things that I want to explore as a writer.
Well, not to sound presumptuous, but it seems like during this process, you yourself have undergone a certain sea change, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've all of my work has, I think, helped ground me profoundly and has given me, a sense of, I don't want to say completion, but it's I've worked through a lot of my own family's trajectory, my own sort of political concerns, my own experiences as a writer through these books, and now you want to see what you have next in you, you know?
Yeah, and I know in some of your interviews you've told how your journalism, which I haven't even touched upon, but your journalism has kind of informed this whole process in a way.
The journalism work I've done as a journalist has managed to creep its way back in, so there's always been scenes and images from my experiences as a journalist that have found their way of having a second life in my fiction. It's been really rewarding.
Well, Danal, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Your book is sitting on our front table, several copies of it.
And
people have been buying it, and hopefully after this, and as I said, as I want to tell everybody, when we listen to this broadcast, it's going to be available on our YouTube channel actually now, and on iTunes. You just have to type Danal's name in, either first or last, since it's an unusual name, and the name of the book, and you'll be able to listen to. Unfortunately, me butt in and interrupt repeatedly. So anyway, yeah, thanks again, and hopefully, if you're ever in the Philadelphia area, just come by the bookstore, and we'd love to see you.
It would be a pleasure to. Thank you so much for the conversation.
You're welcome. Oh, okay, I'm doing the whole thing? Okay. All right. Next week on The Avid Reader, we'll be talking with Bea Ridgway, author of The River of No Return. River of No Return is a time travel book with a bunch of swashbuckling battles, and it creates a real romantic feeling as well. So it combines three genres, but it really is a good time travel book, and I love those kinds of books. And B will be appearing at our store on Thursday, May 8th at 7 p.m. to sign, read, questions, whatever. You know where we are by now, just across from the Downingtown interchange of the Turnpike in the Eagle View community. Just follow the purple signs to the retail shops, and we're right above the restaurant Brickside. And as I've said, we're now on not only WCHG, but Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, our YouTube channel. And so I thought, although my manager is going to be upset, if you come in and tell us that you've listened to this interview next week with B, and if you've listened to it on WCHG or Facebook or Twitter or Pinterest, and you can prove it to me, then the first five of you, I'll give a free signed copy of The River of No Return. So I just thought of that. So, and the following week, with regard to Bea Ridgway, our book club will be meeting on two separate days. The 14th, which is a Wednesday in the afternoon between 2 and 4, and the following Thursday, because we have so many members now, which is our evening session, that'll be the 15th, from 7 to 9 in the evening. So come in, join our book club. It's a great book to start with. It's got lots of things to talk about, and people will have different opinions about what happened in the book and what's going to happen in the sequel, because there will be one. We provide cookies, coffee, other kinds of goodies. And so come by and see us. And look forward to talking to you next week.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.